you're being paranoid, Richard. But Richard insisted, so Ollie brought technicians in, and they found bugs.
Well, so, we have to leave it there. But people can pick up this latest book of the great literary giant Richard Wright. Thank you so much to his daughter, Julia Wright, The Man Who Lived Underground, just published. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Veterans Your Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7, and streaming live at radiofreenashville.org. Here's a poem. The penetrated, evaporated, disintegrated, eviscerated, decapitated, mind and soul amputated, burnt and blown up, brain damaged, bled out and heart failed. And here in section 60 at Arlington, the smashed and trashed who survived the blast but didn't last, or suicided at home but were killed elsewhere, also have their last deployment here in section 60. Or some variation people respect and admire, but don't aspire to, ignoring those who mostly survived and only somewhat died. On Memorial Day, most folks play, while only a few caress the tombstones of the angelfied. The majority know what to do. Stuff your mind with barbecue. That was a poem by Horace Coleman, which was printed in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War periodical, The Veteran. It is a perfect setup for our special show leading into Memorial Day. But first, my name is Jim Waldgermuth, and I'm here with co-host and fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org for more information. This show is on stations across the country thanks to the Pacific Radio Network. We're also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcast, Spotify, and on your phone. Just go to your podcast app and search Veterans for Peace. The Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville are supported in part by the Green Party of Tennessee, bringing some common sense into the bipolar world of American politics. Go to greenpartyoftennessee.org. This is the Thursday before Memorial Day. Today we will reflect on those referenced in the poem, those who mostly survived and only somewhat died, because the number of those that continue to suffer from the effects of war, both physical and psychological, far outseed those remembered with headstones and names etched on a wall. Today we have Michael and Cynthia Orange, both authors. Michael has written two books, Fire in the Hole and Embracing the Ghosts, PTSD and the Vietnam Quagmire. Cynthia has written Take Good Care, Sing Your Own Song, New Life, New Friends, Making and Keeping Relationships in Recovery, and the Nautilus Award-winning book Shockwaves, A Practical Guide to Living with a Loved One's PTSD. They're here to help us reflect on Memorial Day, and will share their own stories of PTSD and the care of someone with PTSD. So instead of me introducing them any further, Michael, Cynthia, welcome to the show. Could you both please jump in? And just initially, what is your feelings about Memorial Day? What does that mean to you?
I have not attended a Memorial Day ceremony that does what you're describing for decades. I joined Veterans for Peace in 1991, with the buildup of the Iraq War, first Iraq War, and the invasion of Iraq then. And since then, my Memorial Days has been with Veterans for Peace. So, you know, I understand, you know, the use of sporting events, Memorial Day, Veterans Day, ROTC, all of these mechanisms of our militaristic society to convince young men and women, many of whom don't have a good future in our society, to join the military and be a part of our 737 bases around the world and armed forces in I don't know how many countries, almost everywhere in the continent, basically. So no, it's the antithesis of our effort at Veterans for Peace to end war as a U.S. Foreign policy, primary foreign policy. A pet peeve of mine is that you can go into the smallest town anywhere in this country and you will find some memorial glorifying the dead and the past wars. And to me, there should be a memorial twice as big for all of the people who suffered the losses of the families, the loved ones, and not just those that died, but those that, as the poet was saying, came back not whole, not completely dead. And I include my wife in that. I want a memorial just for you.
Well, that would be lovely. What are the numbers now? The 22 veterans and active duty soldiers each day who commit suicide. You know, where's their memorial?
Right.
Yes.
And you can go, you know, to the Vietnam Wall or the many memorials Michael mentioned, or your mention of Arlington, that wonderful poem you read, Jim. It's been a long frustration of ours, and it sounds like all three of us share that same frustration, that this country is so short-sighted when it comes to embracing the reality of what these things should mean. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness for Vets for Peace and other groups like them that bring our awareness to these issues you're talking about.
None of us are diminishing the sacrifice. That's not the issue.
No.
It's that sacrifice is then used by the government for the ongoing.
And they always speak about people giving their lives when there may be instances of that. I don't doubt that there are people who do acts of tremendous courage in battle, whatever they, you know, whether it's done with any higher sense of what they're doing or not, but most of those who lose their lives didn't give them, their lives were taken from them.
Their lives were taken, as were the many civilians.
Yes, don't even talk.
Lost to war, too.
So Michael, you've actually been diagnosed with PTSD.
Took 33 years, but yeah.
Yes.
So.
And Jim, that's what my book is about. The title of the book is very purposeful: Embracing the Ghosts, PTSD, and the Vietnam Quagmire. The Embracing the Ghosts come from a story of a friend of mine, another combat veteran, who was in group therapy at the VA. And he said that the group therapist used a metaphor, an analogy for the group. And that's as if they're all on a bus, they're driving a bus, and behind them on the bus are their ghosts. They're ghosts from Vietnam or Iraq or Cambodia or Afghanistan. And they're driving, and the idea is just keep driving and don't get off the bus. So the metaphor is that keep this stuff behind you. Getting off the bus is the equivalent of suicide. So you can understand the VA's concept of triage, you know, as it's a very real thing. And the main purpose then was just keep these guys alive. My advice to that group would have been stop the bus, turn around, embrace every one of your ghosts as teachers, and handle it that way, embracing the ghost. So that's where the metaphor comes from, or the title of my book. I thought a good place to start would be I thought I'd do a little excerpt from it. Excellent. And it's a good setup for the experience I had prior to getting therapy, the things that led up to therapy. And I should, one little note, I served in the Marines in a mortar platoon in from 1969 to 70. So this is from my book, Embracing the Ghosts. When I went to war, I was a little over 20, not a child, but not yet an adult. When I arrived at the Cleveland airport after my tour of duty in Vietnam, I just sat down paralyzed with befuddled emotions. I didn't even call my parents to tell them I was home. I was afraid my family would expect to see the person I was and not accept the person I had become, that they would not forgive me for what I had done and not done in Vietnam. How could they when I couldn't forgive myself? Like some toxic virus morphing in a petri dish, the war infected my moral DNA. I came home no longer thinking with the same mind, seeing with the same eyes, hearing with the same ears. The Marines had trained me in the belief that I could kill people because they were the enemy and they would try to kill me. The rounds I fired still did kill people in Vietnam, some who had tried to kill me, but I know there were also civilians caught in the carnage that is war. Sitting in that airport terminal, I was neither able to judge my actions and inactions nor to fully grasp the transformation I had undergone. I found it hard to describe the differences between life in a war zone and life back in the world, as we soldiers refer to it. In combat, emotions became so extreme they create their polar opposites. Terror can spark adrenalized excitement. Panic can birth the resolution required to control it. And I remember the unrelenting chaos of a firefight when I hugged the ground as if the safety of burrowing into it could avoid being buried in it. And finally screaming into the cacophony, I want it to stop, I want it to stop. In Vietnam, we had a mantra, it don't mean nothing. Mm-hmm. Just don't mean nothing. It was a necessary all-purpose lie we used as a bandage to keep our consciences from bleeding out and as a mask to hide our faces from ourselves, from each other, and from our role as aggressors. We got so good at telling this lie that we kept telling it even after we came home to a nation that didn't want to hear our stories. Vietnam gave me the opportunity to explore the very best in me and to face the very worst. Boot camp was designed to swap out civilian ethics with the militaristic replacements needed to deal with the barbarism that is war. But when discharged, there was no boot camp to reverse engineer the process. When I came home, I was unaware that I was suffering from what would become known as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, even though it formed the fault line of my personality change. I repressed the war, my experiences, and especially what I had learned about my dark side. It don't mean nothing. I went back to college that fall of 1970, and I tried to fit back into my former cocoon. I had to restrain my urge to revolt at the triviality of my classmates' concerns while I still had friends rotting back in the jungle. It strained my nerves until I thought they would fry from too much voltage. Instead of screaming, I just went along like a foreigner, pretending to understand the conversation. In Vietnam, I heard stories about anti-war protesters, and I knew my college friends thought the war was immoral. I gave this some weight, but I had more important matters to attend to, like checking for tripwire one pace ahead and straining bomb crater water through my teeth. I needed a moral handhold there, illusory though it was, that we were doing something important, honorable, and necessary as I hung over the cliff of the war's dark insanity. After coming home and returning to college, I lost my voice on the highly politicized Kent State University campus. I had no railroad tracks to press my ear to sense what was steaming my way. Fearful of the stigma society laid on us Vietnam vets, I became a closet vet. I knew my handholds were slipping.
Were you at Kent State when they killings occurred?
I happened to be on campus on came on campus on May 2nd, 1970.
Wow.
I was a deckhand on an ore boat at the time, jump ship for another long story. This is my first book, Harvey. You'll have to read that one. And I was there when the National Guard was mobilized because of the disturbances downtown. And then, but I had to catch my ship, so I left on May 3rd, caught my ship on May 4th.
Wow.
When the murders occurred. So I was there for the stuff that led up to it.
You know, Michael, I can relate to your attitudes, if not what you went through while you were in country as a Marine, because I can remember so clearly, and you refreshed my memory. That phrase don't mean nothing. We'd send it, you know, people would be walking up and down the deck, and we'd be supplying the ammunition. Don't mean nothing. We'd cruise into within several thousand yards of the beach and lob shells into a jungle for absolutely no purpose. Don't mean nothing. And then, like you, when I got out in 72, I got out, and that was it. And I went back to college, didn't tell anybody about who I was, what my service was. Okay, I was a freshman who could drink. How did I manage to pull that? How did I manage to pull that off? Well, if somebody was really interested, then I'd let them know. But, you know, I didn't offer that I was a veteran.
I'll tell you, when I came back to the Bay Area, I didn't have a uniform. My only identifying thing was my haircut was too short. So there aren't too many short haircuts in the Bay Area in 1969. The only real negative reactions I ever got anywhere in the Bay Area was when I was trying to get a job, and I would, call and try to set up an appointment, and they'd ask me, what was my last job? And I said, well, I just got back from the Navy. I just got out of the Navy. I was over there off Vietnam. And they said, well, don't call us, we'll call you. And I'd never hear back from any of them.
Right.
It was like I was suspect just from that history, you know.
It's kind of interesting hearing Michael go back to that time, because we actually met in 1968 before he went to Vietnam. He was with a group of friends from Ohio, and I was with a couple of girlfriends from Minnesota. And we met at the top of the Empire State Building.
I read that, yeah.
Yeah, the observation deck. I mean, it's like this bee love story. But he went off to Vietnam, and I was actually one of the people marching against the war. But I think what gets lost when we think about the protesters, so many of us had friends and loved ones who were in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So we were very clear about separating the warrior from the war.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think, you know, the generalities about veterans and about protesters all get muddied somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I also find it interesting when you, like, you know, I think both of you are talking about how silent you were when you came home. Well, for Vietnam vets especially, I think that silence could last decades, and Iraq, those images of Iraq brought it back. But that doesn't mean veterans weren't having symptoms that weren't diagnosed.
Yeah.
And I remember writing that the war sleeps between us. You know something's going on, but it gets masked, or in some cases, veterans, you know, try to numb those feelings with addictive drugs or addictive behaviors. In Michael's case, it was workaholism, which meant when you're buried in something else, you're not paying attention to your family. Yeah. So then the family starts having these feelings of inadequacy and befuddlement. You may have read that I said I felt like I was lost in the bewilderness. all these things are going on simultaneously. And then, do you want to talk about how you came to be diagnosed?
My book focuses a lot on my therapy. And it was 33 years after coming home that I just finally decided I had to go in. And I'll read an excerpt that kind of describes my experiences, but the beauty of this was that two things. One, the therapist I found was also a grunt, a army grunt in Vietnam, who, well, we walked the same walk, and we just had this amazing communication. And he knew what I needed. He knew what I had experienced. And the other thing was my wife, Cynthia. And I'll get into that some more. But I had 44 sessions over a 9-month period, no drugs. But every one of them, I came home, and the 50 minutes in the therapist's office, and at least an hour to an hour and a half describing everything to Cynthia. And somehow you listened through all of that, advised me through all of that. I made over 100 pages of notes, single-spaced, on my computer. And that's really the core of the book, that experience, what I learned from that. So let me read a short excerpt, kind of a prelude to that.
Are you talking about your friends?
I haven't yet.
Okay.
The most difficult symptom I experienced since Vietnam was what I call my crash into my primordial sadness. My sadness was a physical thing, a dark force, a looming presence, a lurking beast. Oh, my, Thomas is the name of my therapist. With Thomas's help, I learned to recognize this deep, debilitating sadness as a psychological place with two warring inhabitants. The first is the apprehensive voice of a traumatized 20-year-old Marine. And the other is the falsely empowered young man who takes on an attitude of contempt for his own pain. To use a male-female analogy, the timid feminine voice feels the pain of the trauma and the tears flow. And a moment later, the harsh masculine voice immediately says to stuff it, quit whining. It was like those two cartoon characters of the devil and the angel that sit on opposite shoulders, giving opposite directions. The military, and especially the Marine Corps, promises to make men out of boys. Unfortunately, the experience usually accomplishes half the job. We come out of the fires of war with our masculine halves strong as tempered steel, but our feminine halves jailed by our testosterone-driven halves. Far from the confident men they promised, many of us emerged scared and scarred, stuck in a sort of teenage immaturity. My crash experience materializes as an undercurrent, like a tremor in the earth. A pit opens and I become trapped in a sketch by artist M.C. Escher of stairs that never stop going down. I became a walled-off small boy, then hammer blows of guilt, remorse, confusion send me reeling into emotional cartwheels, feeling, stuffing, crying, rocking, being embarrassed, then berating myself, then starting all over again. I lacked the weapons to fend them off. I didn't understand it, could not explain it, could not control it. My bawling like a baby so embarrassed me, I only felt safe in Cynthia's tender arms. This would go on and on until I didn't think I had any more tears left in me, and the day had gone by. Thomas offered an explanation. He said, the harsh boy had served to protect you from the poison of war and to help you develop a good life. Now you're mature enough and strong enough to take the next step and reintegrate all aspects of your personality, including the tender-hearted boy. We did this extremely difficult work together. My God, I should not use Vietnam and PTSD as a convenient excuse whenever reality didn't match up to my expectations. It's a mental disorder, said Thomas, not a cop-out. I would soon discover that therapy keeps me more honest. So that's the excerpt.
Yeah. Now
that's what I was going in.
Yeah. It took you 33 years to get to the point where you're going to meet Thomas. What? And you were suffering for 33 years, and Cynthia was suffering right along with you. But what was the thing that got you to, okay, now I got to go?
No, I can do it. I have trouble with this. I had a real good friend in Vietnam, called him Scrounger. And I didn't make that many friends in Vietnam. You know, it was the idiocy of the army to have us rotate in and out. I was hesitant to get close to people for fear that, well, they'd be leaving or we'd lose them. But with the Scrounger, Chris, we got close. And I had connected with his family after my book was published in 2001, Fire in a Hole, A Mortar Man in Vietnam. And Chris's brother informed me that Chris had died some years earlier. And then when he had read my book, he told me that he, rather than a car accident, that his brother, older brother, had named his daughter after Chris, Christine, and that every year Chris would drive down from Niagara Falls to North Carolina to visit his namesake every year, and they would give him extra pillows that he had to put over his ears because he kept... Why don't you finish it? I always have trouble.
He kept hearing
the rounds. Yeah.
The rounds.
Yeah.
And then, but the family's story was that, as Michael said, he had died in a car accident. Well, after his brother read Michael's book, he said, "I want you to know the truth." He was on his way to visit his niece when he stopped at a wayside rest, and he had written a 14-page, stop me if I have this wrong, but a 14-page letter to his family all about Vietnam. And he had never talked, I mean, he was a successful businessman or accountant, I can't remember, but he had never talked about the war to his family. Mm-hmm. Yet, this is in 2001? Okay.
Yeah.
I can do it.
He pulled off to the side of the road. He had a can of gas, dumped it all over himself.
He tied himself and dumped it over himself, lit the match, and committed suicide. And then Michael, who had always kind of brushed off his own experience, says, "Oh, other people had it much worse than I did, much worse than I did. I don't deserve empathy. I don't deserve anything. I'm here. I survived." Mm-hmm. And when he heard about this friend, he looked at his own experience through a different lens because his experience was the same experience. They had served together. They had experienced the same thing. Yes. And you allowed yourself to feel. And then I can't remember when Paul Wellstone's plane went down in the midst of this.
Oh, it all happened.
All this was going on. Paul Wellstone and
I remember that in the notes I saw about Paul Wellstone.
And Paul Wellstone endorsed Michael's book, his first book. So, he's a Minnesota guy. And that was happening, and Iraq invasion was happening.
Yeah.
So it's like, the dominoes all fell. It was the perfect storm for the
Yeah.
The old version of shock and awe. It's like, oh wow, something's going on here. And fortunately, we have a community of supportive people, and I kind of instinctively knew that I can't help him, but I know a Green Beret who's in therapy who maybe can.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this guy was over and took you to the VA, yeah. And that was the start of the therapy. So that's, and that was after decades of this knowing something's happening and something's wrong, but we didn't have a name for it.
Yeah.
Right. How did you deal, Cynthia? How did you cope?
With Michael getting diagnosed?
Well, with Michael before he was diagnosed.
Well, being a person who has chronically suffered from low self-esteem, I of course thought, what am I doing wrong? Is he not paying attention to me? Is he exercising compulsively, riding his bike, doing triathlons, working compulsively because he doesn't want to be around me? Am I, you know, what's happening? So I internalize it. And then, so when he finally did get the diagnosis, because PTSD wasn't a diagnosable condition until, what, the early 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, it was called different things in World War II. It was shell shock in the Civil War. It was soldiers' heart. Or, so it was a relief to have a name for it, but then the hard work of therapy began, and as he describes in his book, it was hard work for both of us, it turned out, because you became pretty withdrawn and secluded, which means we became pretty withdrawn and secluded. And I originally went to therapy with a separate therapist to find out how I could best support him. And she said, let's put Michael aside for a minute. Who's helping you with your war?
Yeah.
And I absolutely lost it. Like, I have a right to get help. So I hope that makes sense and explains it.
And Cynthia's written this incredible national award-winning book, Shockwaves, that chronicles not just our experience, but the similar experiences for caregivers and people with PTSD from around the world. It's an absolutely remarkable, remarkable book.
But there wasn't anything out there for families.
No, not for families.
So as a writer, I thought, well, I guess I'll try writing something for families.
The subtitle tells it all, A Practical Guide to Living with the Loved Ones with PTSD.
So, Cynthia, tell us about your book.
Oh, well, that's what it is. I have a wonderful publisher and who gave me the resources. So I interviewed not only survivors of war, but families affected by suicide and rape survivors, Oklahoma City bombing survivors. Mm-hmm. So it's trauma in general, but woven throughout it is the story of our families, how trauma trickled down to our daughter and our family.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of that book recently grew another one for caregivers. So that one's called Take Good Care. So it kind of dovetails the other one.
You have a wonderful I think it's a poem. Yeah, it's a poem that Jessica wrote about approaching Michael, her dad, when he's sleeping. Could you read that?
Yes, called Waking Him. Careful not to startle him, she tiptoes into the room and watches. His eyes are squeezed shut and twitch slightly with the intensity of his sleep. Quietly, she calls him, Daddy? Daddy, are you sleeping? she has learned to wake him slowly. If she is too sudden, he will uncoil a fierce spring rusted loose. Gently, she must nudge him back into the world of fenced-in yards and refrigerator art, away from the shadowy echoes of rotten canvas and death. She knows her child hand is not enough, because even she is in some of those dreams, staggering with him, shoeless through mud. That is all he will say. He tries to protect her, but she hears the screams at night. She already knows she must use caution in the waking. Mm-hmm. And just although, you know, we thought naively that we were protecting our daughter from
right.
the residue of PTSD, mm-hmm. but children, as this show, she wrote it, although she wrote it years after childhood, when I think she was in high school when she wrote this. You know, that's the other thing that happens, is you just are unaware of how PTSD affects our children too. They sense it. They sense the tension.
If you don't mind, I want to go back to 1968. You've just met this pretty girl, and then all of a sudden, and there seems to be a connection there, and you say, I'm joining the Marines. All right. So just a couple of questions to follow up on that. Why did you join the Marines? And then after you're in your book, you said, I think this is the quote, I felt betrayed, but I just kept shooting.
Those were complex times. A lot going on in 1968 from the outer world in. We had the assassination in 63 for JFK, 68 for Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X in 67, I think, 68 for Martin Luther King. Vietnam was just splitting the whole country apart, brothers against brothers, parents against children, students against blue collar. And I was caught in the middle of that on the Kent State campus. And one of my stories is trying to take a calculus course in Vietnam, because I had to have that three courses of calculus. First one I got a C, second one a D, third one was an F, and I was ready to be drafted. So it was a kind of a FU to the world, that I'll just join the military and get free education if I survive whatever happens. So everything was kind of blowing up in my life, and it was just basically almost a suicide wish, you know, like join the Marines. It was nuts. My father was in the Marine Corps, so I think that was part of a giving my father the finger, well, I'll show you, and off I went. No good reasons, and maybe a dozen good reasons.
To follow up on that statement, I felt betrayed. I mean, it didn't take long for most of us to figure out, no.
Yeah.
We're occupying, or we're trying to occupy a country of farmers who just want to farm. And so that statement, I felt betrayed, because there seems to be in today's Iraq, Afghanistan vets that are willing to talk, there is a lot of that. Wait a second. I felt betrayed.
Yes.
This is what I signed up for. And we hear a lot of that from the younger people, the post 9/11 veterans in Veterans for Peace.
I think I describe it actually as three betrayals. And the first is I kind of grew up in a, you know, middle class white suburb of Cleveland with a Leave It to Beaver household, I thought. And that's another long story. But within that, being raised as a Catholic, I even went on to Catholic seminary for 4 years for high school. So I was inculcated in the patriotism of the era. Loved my both my parents served in World War II, so I was all in for these wonderful Hollywood pro-war movies, Dirty Dozen and Guns of Navarone and all of these romanticizing the horrors of war, but done so with these heroes, wonderful heroes. So growing up with that, and then on top of that, load the anti-communism that was inherent in Christianity and certainly the Catholic Church. And this stuff all fell apart for me on the campus in 1966 and 67 of Kent State. I started to understand the politics a little bit, not enough to be smart about it. Martin Luther King said, the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence on the planet today, and it's still true. 1968, when I went in, more than half the people in the country, the adults in the country, were saying it's either a mistake or immoral. And I still went. And I think the reason comes back more to this rite of passage, that it was all part of this transitioning from this maybe privileged white kid from the suburbs needing to become a man and separate from, go beyond the raising that my parents had and go way beyond the dogma of the Catholic Church. I'm not a Christian, haven't been a Christian since I think December 1970 or 69 in Vietnam, and that's also written up in my book. Nothing to do with it. And then, so those two betrayals, like the family raising, the Christianity and the messages of anti-communism and hatred that are built into there. And thirdly, the politics of Vietnam. Yeah, it was three giant betrayals right there.
But along with betrayal comes the whole issue of grief and loss. And I think that's one of the things, not only with PTSD, but with surviving the military in combat, is there's a, and that ties in nicely with Memorial Day, because there are so many kinds of losses, and we don't honor our grief enough. And I think that grief is so all-encompassing, and that the losses are so complex and deep. Trauma is always with you. You just learn to carry it differently. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, it's not something you get over. And if I could build on something that you said, Jim, about contemporary military and veterans. Michael and I attended in 2008 the winter soldier hearings of the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. Mm-hmm. And we were covering it, both supporting the Vets for Peace guys and Iraq Vets Against the War, but also as writers. So we were out in D.C. or just adjacent to D.C. And nobody, you know, well, a lot of people didn't hear about the Winter Soldier hearings in 71 with Vietnam vets, but, you know, how many people know that Iraq and Afghanistan vets had Winter Soldier hearings also?
Exactly.
When you talk about betrayal and war stories, here they were talking so courageously, these young people, men and women, testifying about their experiences, the lies that they were told, and the atrocities that they were told to commit and that they saw committed. And you realize, I mean, at one point, I remember Michael and I going out in the hall after listening to testimony after testimony and just embracing each other and weeping in this hallway, thinking, oh my God, when will this ever end? And I think what you're saying is so true, that thank you for having this radio program. Thank you for getting the word out there. Thank you for encouraging people to use these holidays, with air quotes, as an opportunity to reflect upon really, really difficult, excruciating truths about war, about the military, and about our government when it comes to these things. So thank you.
Yes. I'd like to jump to an aspect of my book that I think makes it different. I covered, there are like two chapters to my experience with these 44 sessions in therapy. And the beginning portion of it that dealt with my experiences in Vietnam were one part of it, but really the harder part was my therapist, and probably most therapists will do this, went back to childhood issues. Mm-hmm. And it was the idea of looking for childhood precursors that would have an effect upon adult, in this case, combat-induced PTSD. And I found the childhood stuff much more difficult to deal with. I really did. In an odd way, the crap I dealt with in Vietnam, in a way, it warranted therapy. I mean, seeing children blown up, trying to come up with a body count based on scattered parts, or that kind of stuff. You go, yeah, I need help for that. But what really became more difficult is going back in time. One of the ghosts I learned to embrace is to see my experiences in Vietnam as I viewed them as a 20-year-old young man, rather than the middle-aged man who was in a therapist's office. I had to take that same perspective to look at childhood, to see it not through my 55-year-old eyes, but through the eyes of a 9 or 10-year-old boy. Thomas asked me, well, what was your upbringing? And I gave him this stock answer, like I said, white, suburb, middle class, we lacked nothing, good clothes, good education, parents loved us, they worked all the time. And he kind of stopped me and he says, well, is there another aspect there? And I said, well, they both were alcoholics. And I was like, how does that change the formula?
Yeah.
And what I had to do, it really took a while to come to grips with that sort of, to admit that those childhood circumstances were affecting me as an adult. I mean, dealing with war felt like a macho, a male thing to do, right? But the childhood stuff, I was, it didn't mean nothing. It don't mean nothing. Mm-hmm. What I thought would be helpful is that what my book does is I did a lot of research of psychologists. And if I could build trust with my reader on the first part of the book that deals with the, let's say, the macho aspects of dealing with combat-induced PTSD, then maybe they'll trust me on the second half that deals with, say, more feminine side, or the tender-hearted boy that dealt with childhood stuff. And I would not have read a John Bradshaw or a Terrence Real or a Ken Druck. Not part of my reading list normally, but taking them on, these wise therapists, I learned so much about how the childhood stuff does have an effect.
Well, it also informs your decisions to enlist
The
messages you were given in childhood, just like you're saying,
yes,
inform your decision, your choices about going to war.
Becoming a man.
Gotta be the man.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrence Real wrote this book, I Don't Want to Talk About It. It's a perfect title. And it's about fathers and their sons. And he writes, until Vietnam vets demanded the medical sector deal with their PTSD, society blamed soldiers for their weakness, for their unmanliness, and their cowardice of double injury. And he went on to describe the psychological underpinnings why and how a father who was abused by his father can pass on that same abuse to his son in a trickle-down fashion. This is what he wrote. Boys don't hunger for their fathers who will model masculinity. They hunger for their fathers who will rescue them from it. They need fathers who have themselves emerged from the gauntlet of their own socialization with some degree of emotional inactness. Sons don't want their father's balls. They want their hearts. What we give our awareness is performance-based selfish, not an essential sense of worth that comes from within. One cannot earn self-esteem, one has it. Performance-based esteem augments an insufficient sense of worth by measuring of one's accomplishments against others. I kind of categorized what my book is about as head work and heart work. Mm-hmm. So I've talked quite a bit about the head work from the psychologists, the psychiatrists, and that kind of a thing. But it really comes down to the heart work, and that was having compassion for myself as a 20-year-old mm-hmm. young man in Vietnam and what that young man experienced, and also compassion for the 9-10-year-old boy growing up in a dysfunctional alcoholic household, and importantly, compassion for my parents and their generation who didn't have the kinds of tools that we have. Therapy basically wasn't even popular at all. It was a negative. So they were subject to the same kind of trickle-down abuse that they got from their parents. So I was able to get compassion all around.
In one of my chapters starts out with a quote from that I've always loved from Pablo Neruda. And I had to jump through hoops to get permission to use it in my book, but I love it. And I think that this is what I learned as a support person for a loved one who has been diagnosed with PTSD, or even if they haven't been diagnosed, if there's trauma going on. If each day falls inside each night, there exists a well where clarity is imprisoned. We need to sit on the rim of the well of darkness and fish for fallen light with patience. And what I love about that quote is, you know, I follow it explaining that trauma comes from the Greek word for wound. And when you're tending, when you're supporting someone who's been deeply wounded, you know, you just don't jump in and you just can't fix it, but you just need to be. And if you're a control freak like I am, that's really hard to do. And another hard thing was to sit back and know when I was the one to listen, or if there was someone else who in that instance, in that situation, might be more appropriate for Michael to listen to. Perhaps it was the therapist, perhaps it was another veteran, perhaps it was another friend who he just needed to go biking with. And that was really, when you love someone, you want to fix it, you know, whether it's our children or our spouse or our parent. And you can't always do that. So I guess the practical side of it is just talking about what is trauma, what is PTSD, how do you identify it, what is hyperarousal, and understand that you also need to be able to take breaks from it. Mm-hmm. There were times when your Vets for Peace were having a gathering, and I said, I have to take a break from Vietnam. I just have to. And we've gotten good about it. Took a long time to be able to communicate without our defenses, our respective defenses going up. But so the book identifies what it is, what it isn't, how it can trickle down. It gives resources. There are great resources out there for how to deal with children and how to best support children when there's PTSD in a family, perhaps what not to say, what to say. Yeah.
I think what's wonderful about Cynthia's book are the interviews, the stories, because the range of stories that she has in there, every one of them is an avenue for a reader. Everyone, you know, one might be a war story, one might be a sexual trauma, a sexual abuse trauma. So there's a story for so many different readers to connect and see, find the lessons.
All right, so let's repeat the titles of these books again. So Cynthia, what's the title of your book?
It's called Shockwaves, A Practical Guide to Living with a Loved One's PTSD.
Excellent, and that's one of your books. So
that's
you've
one.
Got-
and the other one that people might find helpful is called Take Good Care, Finding Your Joy in Compassionate Caregiving. And that's for caregivers of all definitions, whether you're doing a favor for someone but it talks about how to care for yourself. And self-care is a huge part of both books.
Yes.
Because we can lose ourselves in caring for others and forget that, you know, it's the old oxygen mask analogy of the person on the plane where they tell you to put your own oxygen mask on first before you go to help your child or help mm-hmm. the person next to you.
Yeah.
And you're of no use if you don't care for yourself. So that's a big theme throughout both books.
Yes.
Great, great. And Michael?
My first book was 2001, Fire in the Hole, A Mortar Man in Vietnam. And then this current book is Embracing the Ghosts, PTSD and Vietnam Quagmire. So Fire in the Hole describes my experiences going to war, what happened in Vietnam, what happened afterwards. And then this Embracing the Ghost picks up my life 33 years later with the therapy to deal with Vietnam primarily.
So you wrote Fire in the Hole before therapy.
Right. Right, 20 years,
Jesus.
13 years earlier, 17.
Now, we normally end with a song, and Harvey had a recommendation. Harvey, you want to explain that?
I don't know if you're familiar with Mary Gaucher. She has a song called The War After the War.
Sounds perfect.
That's sung from the perspective of the spouse.
So there was our special Memorial Day show with Cynthia and Michael Orange, helping us to remember the real purpose of Memorial Day. So let's go out and remember Memorial Day. Now here's Mary.
Who's gonna care for the ones who care for the ones who went to war? There's landmines in the living room and eggshells on. Lost myself in the shadow of your honor and your pain. You stare out of the window.
Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Tune in on fourth Thursdays at 3 a.m. for The Metal Margin with me, your host, The Metal Maestra, featuring all women and people of color in metal, including this band from Navajo Nation, female-fronted Existence AD. And all women bands like Nervosa and Devil Oof. That's The Metal Margin here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, fourth Thursdays at 3 a.m.